energy-rich field which operates in space as pure energy, and it's not constrained by the inertia of matter.
Mm-hmm.
But it is more viable as energy, and these are just conjectures. And I'd like to lead into these conjectures step by step, rather than trying to go from the observation to the answer, because there's a lot of reasoning that goes on in between that we haven't gotten to yet on this program.
Right. Now, you believe in energy fields. That would be an energy field. I would like to propose another conjecture to you, if you don't mind. You can cut me off if I'm going too far.
I want you to make it quick. We've got a lot of them on the board here that want to get in, Sam.
Right on. Okay, I saw one. Second time I saw it, I tried to go into the trip out of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether I did or not, but I saw a people sitting in a circle with a round table in the middle. They looked something like chubby people. They were white. They were not brown. And they answered me a few questions, but when I asked them a personal question of mine, something scientific, medical scientific for me, they told me to wait, that my civilization would develop what it would be needed for me to get cured. And then they said, sorry, we're too far for further communication, and I felt like a snap, and I was wide awake. I don't know what happened. This could be imagination, it could be truth.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the second time they saw it, another question, please. Now, if you have the bodies of these people, aren't they material, cellular, carbon cells, life like we are?
Yes, the answer is that there are autopsy reports of these creatures, and they have a one-for-one correspondence of every bone in the human body, but in different proportions.
Uh-huh.
But they seem to be from the same genetic stock as we are.
Right.
There's some minor differences and some
major differences.
Unusual differences. But I can tell you from the reports that I've seen that all the bones are there one-for-one to the human, except the different proportions, and some are vestigial.
Well,
okay, does that help you, Sam?
Yeah, it helps. But how does these people with bones and body and cells and skin and that can travel in this? Now, when I saw it myself, but I have myself in my mind, they don't have no motion in there. They are real calm, cool, and collected, like they were stationary, although they are moving at fantastic speed.
Well, that's what Dad tried to explain a little bit earlier.
And I think there's a device aboard the craft which puts out a field which controls everything in the vicinity of the craft and makes this kind of travel possible for any creature within the craft, because humans have been doing this traveling as well.
All right.
Okay, Sam?
All right, sure. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
And we have Mark on the line. Hello, Mark.
Hi.
What's up?
I wanted to know if you think that aliens live among us.
Oh, that's a very challenging question. In fact, that was the first question that I was asked in the House of Lords in Parliament. And I had an answer for it, which I'll give you. Actually, I don't know exactly whether or not any specific person is an alien who's among us, but I have a test for a recent alien that I'd like to share with you. Since 1945, the world has been doing atmospheric nuclear testing, and as you know, the world has contaminated itself with the byproducts of radioactivity. In particular, strontium-90 has entered the food chain to the extent that throughout the world, and I'm talking down from darkest Africa to the Eskimos in the North Pole, the people of this planet are contaminated with strontium-90 to the extent of about 20 picocuries per milligram of bone. And that's universal. I shouldn't say universal, it's terrestrial. It's not universal if another civilization was wise enough not to contaminate itself. So we have an interesting test. If an extraterrestrial arrived recently on this planet, the chances are he would not be contaminated with strontium-90. And at last we have a discriminatory test. Now, you can test strontium-90 very easily on the tooth, which is an exposed bone. So if you have a meter to measure strontium-90 radiation level, you just put it to the tooth, and you could tell if a person came from the Earth or if he recently arrived from another world. And I tell you that if you suspect that there's some person in high position, in high power, then what you might do is suggest he test his strontium-90 level. And if it comes out zero, there's a good probability he could never have been created on this planet. And that's a test. Now, if that test is being carried out, I don't know, but it surely caused a stir among people who heard it for the first time. And I just say that the question is very thought-provoking.
Does that help you, Mark?
Not really. I didn't understand all that.
Well, I'll just summarize by saying that if a person is an alien and he came from another place that didn't shoot atom bombs in their own atmosphere, he's not contaminated with strontium-90 in his bones. But if a person was raised on Earth and drank milk that came from cows that ate grass that received fallout from nuclear testing, all Earthlings are contaminated with strontium-90, which is the ash of an atomic bomb. And you can tell this from radioactive measurements of human bone.
Like, do you think the aliens would, like, fit in?
Well, I think that aliens would have a different test result than a human.
Like, do you think they'd look... You know, do you think how would they, like, disguise themselves in society? Like, would they be, like, kind of like us? Or?
Well, some of them couldn't because they're small and they have a different configuration, but there are others that look just like we do.
Well, I tell you that there are aliens who have been... There are aliens who have been observed. And I feel very caught in trying to share my information with you because of some, you know, technical problems. But let it go like this, that there are aliens who can pass for humans. Let's use that as a conjecture, that if aliens look like humans, talk like humans, and walk like humans, they will have a different chemical composition in the sense that they won't be contaminated with radiation if they've arrived here recently. And that is an interesting test that the world could perform. There are some books talking about penetration in one society with another. You might be amused to read that during World War II, when the United States was an ally with Russia, we had a Little East program going, and we would ship war supplies out of Great Falls, Montana, over the pole to Russia, and the planes didn't come back empty. They came back full of Russians, and they were bringing in 100 at a time, and when the plane hit the landing field, these Russians would jump out of the airplane, run off into the woods, and disappear. And there's a book that has been published, it's a little hard to get, but it's called Major Jordan's Diaries. And Major Jordan documented this and showed that, to his knowledge, over 400 Russian aliens landed in Great Falls, Montana in the year 1943, jumped into the woods, never to be seen again, and all these people blended into the American society. So there are at least that many Russian aliens who started families in America and blended into the society and mingled with us and got into our mainstream of life. And those are called affectionately moles. And I'm sure that most countries, when they have an opportunity, put moles in other countries. So why should we rule out this possibility that aliens are not doing the same thing?
As it is paid uniform.
Anyone could make a story up, and, you know, like, that's what I don't understand about you. Like, you could just be making all this up. Like, you don't have someone in opposition to you. Like, everything you say, you could have a scientist that could argue, like, every fact with you.
Yes, and I appreciate what you're saying, and for that reason, I try to conduct my UFO research in the following way. I am not going to examine the truth or falsity on the air of whether a certain observation is correct or incorrect, but rather I will say that suppose this observation has occurred, then let's look at the science of that observation to see if it's feasible. And I was trying to do that on some of the high technology that UFOs possess, and I wanted to do it in just that way to avoid this kind of criticism, which is very hard to answer. So let me try this one on you. If a spaceship hovers, it really doesn't take much energy to do that, because you can calculate that the work required is the force times the distance, and if the distance is zero, the work is zero. Now, that means that if a ship hovers, it doesn't do any work, and it doesn't cost any energy to do it. And I now tell you that we can't do that, even though it takes zero energy. That's your anti-gravity machine. So what I'd like to study on this program is, how do we learn the high technology? Let's not discover whether or not John struck Mary and Mary struck John. I mean, that's not what we're here to do. We're here to probe into the technology. And that's why your alien question was good, because it's pertinent.
So, your term, like, to learn technology from UFOs?
I think there's a lot of technology to be learned, and we'll try and attack it tonight.
Okay, Mark?
Okay.
All right,
thanks.
I'm Bill Jenkins. With me is Edwin Slade tonight. We're on Open Mind at 22 minutes past 10 this Saturday night. Beverly is on the line. Beverly, welcome aboard.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Mr. Slade.
Hello.
I would like to ask you a question about the animal mutilations in our southwestern part of the United States. You mentioned that they do research and they want to find out about our civilization. Does this have any bearing on that?
Well, there's been thousands and thousands of animal mutilations reported, and those attributed to UFOs have one thing in common, which is very unusual, and that is wherever the mutilation occurs, if you look at the site of the mutilation, at the remains of the animal, you find that microscopically the incision or the cut of the mutilated part is done extremely carefully, and it's done so microscopically carefully that the cells at the junction of the cut are not destroyed. The cut is made between the cells so that there is no destruction or rupture of the cells at the intersection of the joint that's cut. And I find that to be very unusual and another example of high technology, incisions.
Why do they call it mutilation, Ed? Because it's a far thing from mutilation. We're talking about some very advanced surgery going on.
Advanced surgery. Well, the mutilation comes from the fact that apparently some animal is senselessly slaughtered out in the field at night, and in the morning, I mean, the head's gone, the blood is all drained from the body, and yet the cells are not disrupted. They're incised surgically, purely, to remove cell from cell without cutting through a cell.
And things like the immune system will be removed. Now, we don't have the surgical ability to do that.
Well, certainly not out in the field without an operating room.
The inside of a heart will be taken without the outside of it being cut.
Those have all been observed, and they're very, very unusual.
Well, Mr. Slade, can I ask you a question? Obviously, they know that they're very intelligent, and they know... why would they study animals? Why would they not study humans? Humans should be mutilated. I don't mean that. But, I mean, they must know the difference between the animal and the human being on the earth.
Well, those humans who have been induced by one means or another to go aboard a spacecraft, an alien spacecraft, and have been examined, have described various procedures of examination where probes and tubes were inserted into their body and blood samples taken and so on. And these were not destructive mutilations in the sense that the patients reported that they were released. So there seems to be a difference that they regard human life with more care than animal life. I don't know of any human mutilations, to answer your question. That's not something that's surfaced with any examples that I'm familiar with.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. Thank you very much.
Okay, Beverly, thank you for your call on that. The human mutilation, or the mutilation problem, has always been... I wonder why the term came, mutilation. We have Doug on the line. Hello, Doug.
Hi, I'm Doug. Anyway, compared to some of these other stories, mine's rather simple.
Okay.
This is quite a while back, about 1948, and I was a car dealer in Spokane. So, anyway, my partners and I, why we decide once in a while to go to Portland for oyster stew, and we'd stop at Pendleton and see Howard Arthur, who managed the airport there. Well, one of the fellows that flew out of there was this Kenny Arnold.
Uh-huh.
And he had an airplane that I don't even know what it was. It was an STOL, you know, short takeoff landing type thing with guy wires on the wings and
whatever.
And anyway, that was the plane that he took the pictures from. All right, well, if you take a range of mountains, like the Cascade Mountains in the background, and you know where you're at, and you know the distance between you and the mountain, you can calculate approximately the distance of the objects that are between you. Well, these particular objects were flying in formation, and he calculated the speed, and they were several times the speed of sound.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before, I believe, we had supersonic aircraft.
That's true. That's
these were actual pictures.
That's correct.
You saw the photos, too?
Yes, I saw them. And then he gave me a book, and I've been trying to find the book. It's put away someplace.
Well, it's, your observation is interesting because it goes back to the premier observation of Ken Arnold, which named the whole flying saucer chapter in history. And I really am interested to know that there are some eyewitnesses that go back that far.
Well, I can verify that part of it, you know, because I've seen him two or three times. And then as far as General LeMay and General Agee, well, I met them a couple times because I built Colonel Tyler's house there in Spokane, and they were out at the SAC base at Fairchild and at Geiger, and they used to come to parties down there, so I met most of those gentlemen, too.
Well, you mentioned the supersonic feature of the flight, and I think that one of the most baffling high-tech aspects of UFOs is that when they do go faster than sound, they don't leave a sonic boom. And there hasn't been a really good explanation of that. But if you can conceive that the UFO, when it's in its flight mode, is a form of energy or a form of electricity, have you, then you can imagine radio waves going through the atmosphere without leaving a shock wave. And you can imagine other forms of electromagnetic energy sailing through the sky without forming a shockwave, because somehow the air molecules have to be undisturbed when the UFO passes through them. And if it passes through in a form of energy, then you solve the problem.
That's beyond my comprehension. All I can say is, like, let's say I'm sitting in the grandstand at Santa Anita Racetrack and I'm looking at the mountains in the background. Or it's possibly, let's say, 30 miles. Or if there are some objects between me and that mountain, and they're not above the mountain, why, we can calculate, say, that they're halfway in between.
That's correct. And
then if we have a reference, a frame of reference, a ground reference, we can calculate the speed that these things are traveling.
Yes.
And they were traveling at a speed that was much greater than anything that was known at that time.
You know, you're touching on a very important point for photographic analysis. Many people have tried to make fake UFO photographs or discriminate between true and false ones, and you're getting into the area which is very interesting, and that is that if you take a photograph of an object like a UFO and with a ground reference, you can determine from simple geometry that the diameter, the visual diameter of the UFO decreases in a way that goes as a tangent angle function. So with distance, the diameter, the optical diameter decreases as the tangent of the angle. But the optical density or the blackness of the photo and the contrast of the photo, that decreases exponentially with distance. So that if you have a series of photographs, you can determine if they're genuine, because the optical density diminishes with a different function than the tangent of the observed angle, optical angle. And that's a way to tell if a series of photographs are genuine. And it's been used very often to get away from people hanging hubcaps up in trees and saying that that was a UFO.
You can also measure the compression of the air in front of the object if it's moving. There are a lot of things now that good analysis will show.
Well, this person didn't do that. He was a professional pilot.
Yep. Yeah, we know the story of it.
He flew people around up there in the mountains and had to have a special type airplane to get in and out of short fields and like that. And he was just a simple pilot. And I don't think he went into trick photography or anything like that. I do believe.
I think that his the validity of Kenneth Arnold has been pretty well established.
Yes.
Doug, thank you very much for your call.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate it. Okay, we have Esther on the line.
Yes.
Okay, Esther.
Well, I've been getting a good laugh all evening about this bunch of baloney that's being talked about UFOs.
Hey, good to have you aboard.
Thank you. Now, what I want to know, sir, these things are supposed to go at supersonic speed. How is it possible for a person to have a camera at the ready? Where, do you go outside with a camera strapped to your back? And how is it possible to take a picture? If you're taking a picture of your Aunt Gussie, you've got to focus that camera a little bit. You've got to tell her to move over to the side. How is it possible for people to take pictures of things
going at supersonic speed? Well, that's what you have to do when you're taking a picture.
Supersonic speed.
Well, I'd love to answer your question.
Please.
They go at supersonic speeds when they're cruising from point to point. But when they're observing some feature on the Earth that interests them, they do go into a hover mode, as we discovered. And they hover, and they sometimes land. And we have a series of photographs here in the studio. It's too bad we're on radio because you can't see them, but we can.
Oh, I see photographs, but that's all made up.
And
somebody takes a lampshade.
Hey, wait a minute, Esther. You know, you could have saved the government billions of dollars. You know that that's made up. We've been spending billions of tax dollars investigating otherwise. And you know what? We found out that you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, neither do any of you people.
Well, I think we do, Esther. You're saying that's all made up, and you have absolutely no data to work from. You have no science at all. The only thing that you're thinking about is that you can't imagine it being so.
No,
so don't sit there and say it's bunk because you don't know what you're talking about.
If something went over the Capitol of the United States, don't you think the newspapers would have printed that?
They did. In 1952.
I never saw any headlines in the paper or on the radio.
I guess it didn't exist, Esther. You didn't see it. Esther, it did happen. There were photographs of it.
Well, then it would have been in all the newspapers all over the world.
Esther, it was. Where were you in 1952?
I was here, all right, but that's so much bosh, and it's amazing how you allow that bosh to go over the air. And why are these UFOs always in these out-of-the-way places? Why aren't they in L.A.?
They're in L.A. all of the time.
Oh,
we have a number of sightings of them in L.A.
And everybody's walking around with cameras taking pictures. This is ridiculous.
Well, Esther, I think you may not have heard our last broadcast, but I had with me the newspaper from the Los Angeles Times, and where they published the photos of the UFOs that were flying over Los Angeles. And I'm trying now to get the date for you so you can go to the library and look up the article.
You want to turn down your headphones there, right?
And this would have been such a...
Look up the article in the Los Angeles Times.
Yeah, but something like this from outer space, from outer worlds, is such a fantastic thing that it would be spread all over and it would be in the papers for a month.
Well, in February 25th, 1942, the headlines were Los Angeles Area Raided, and you can get that article in your library, and you could discover...
Well, it was probably published by the National Enquirer.
No, it was the Los Angeles Times.
Our effect, reasonable facsimile.
Well, is that what you're calling the Times? You're equating that with the Enquirer?
I don't believe that it was in the Times at all.
Well, we're lying to you here, Esther. We're kind of looking at a photocopy of the newspaper.
Well, in our last session, we also read the memorandum report that went to the President of the United States in 1942 that was signed by General George Marshall, Chief of Staff.
You know who George Marshall was, Esther?
Yes, I do. Now,
would you like to read what George Marshall had to say?
No, I want to ask one more question.
All right.
How is it that all these government people, there must be hundreds that you claim know about it, and there's a Hangar 18 that houses that, and not one of them has been able to be bought off by a reporter or somebody they all go around with their lips sealed. That doesn't make sense.
Well, people who work on the projects are sworn to secrecy, and only dedicated people who obey their oath are hired.
Oh, sure.
And that's the only way they make a living, huh?
From 1942 or 52 on, their lips are still sealed.
Well,
no.
Well,
this is a lot of baloney.
No, I read one fellow whose lips were unsealed. 30 years after the event, he decided to publish an affidavit that he saw something. At the time, his lips were sealed, but he thought that in the interests of the expiration of the Secrecy Act in 30 years, it was downgraded to be unclassified, and he disclosed it.
Uh-huh.
So that you find that time wears down the secrecy.
Oh, well, you know, intelligent people, you all sound intelligent enough, and it's really amazing how you can get on the air and
I wonder how intelligent those people were at the United Nations and at the House of Lords of the British Parliament. Are those a bunch of ninnies, too, in your
mind? Well, we just have your word that those meetings took place.
Oh, I see.
We don't know about it. Good night.
Good night, Esther. Now, there's what we call an open mind, gentlemen.
Yes, there's always a diversity of opinion.
That's all right. I love for them to get on here. And, you know, let's hear their point of view. We're 19 minutes away from 11 o'clock on a Saturday night. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. Here's my guest. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. We're talking about the UFO, the reality thereof. Whether you want to believe it or not is... It's not one of those, like, believing in Ford makes a car. It's there. You had something you wanted to say before we go on to the callers, Eric.
Yes, Bill, you know, in looking at the high technology that UFOs exhibit, there's a common thread that I'd like to show that runs through them. I call these high-tech manifestations zero-energy miracles. And they're miracles because they're amazing. We can't do them. We'd like to do them. And when you calculate how much energy is required to do them, it's very, very small. In fact, it's vanishingly small and as close to zero as you please. And I'd like to share those miracles with the audience. The first miracle is hovering indefinitely in the air. Now, that's your anti-gravitation device. That's your levitation device. And as I pointed out, the energy is equal to the force times distance, and if the distance is zero, that it's moving, it's hovering, then the energy required to do that mission is zero.
Well, wouldn't it be using some energy just to fight off gravity?
No.
All right.
Once it establishes a force, and the force is working, but the force is not translating the vehicle through any distance, that requires no energy. The best way to explain that is, suppose you had a South Pole magnet on the table and a North Pole magnet in the air, and the North Pole magnet was directly over the South Pole magnet. The South Pole magnet was against the South Pole on the table, so opposites repel.
Right.
And the magnet would float in the air. Once you get it in a position of equilibrium where the magnetic fields repel, and they're in position where they're balanced, it stays there eternally and hovers eternally, and it doesn't require any energy to do that.
Okay.
And somehow, the UFO has learned this trick in the gravitational field. Mere earthlings can do it in a magnetic field, but we haven't learned to do it in a gravitational field. So it's a zero-energy miracle. Now, if you would like some more zero-energy miracles, there's more.
All
levitation
right.
is one, and the one I'd like to point out to the audience is invisibility.
Mm-hmm. This is
a subject that there's been a lot of secret research on, and the whole phenomena of invisibility is very exciting because if you study the energy requirement to become invisible, it's also very small and close to zero, and yet we can't do it. And there's a third mission, which is walking through a wall.
Not out of body, but in the physical state, it's difficult for us to do that.
I mean, the Invisible Man did that in H.G. Wells' movie, but in reality, it's an experiment that's hard to do in the real world, but it's conceivable to do, and if you plot the energy required to do that, you find out that it doesn't take any energy to walk through a brick wall. However, we can't do it. And that's another example of a zero-energy miracle. And I find this very special class of miracles fascinating because I've worked out theories for them and they all have some common principles. So when you look at closing the hatch on a UFO and welding it, what you're really doing on a microscopic scale is overcoming the van der Waal forces which surround atoms, and you're letting them come close together and cold welding. And when you take them apart, you reverse the process. So a round trip doesn't take any net energy. It's another zero energy miracle. And what we're looking at is a whole library of zero energy miracles that are being reported in connection with UFO sightings. And by golly, there's not one scientist on this earth who can repeat it or reproduce it. And I find that baffling and exciting at the same time.
I hope that one day we can.
I say that if you can do one, you could do them all.
After you've got the key.
Yes.
The basic science is there.
Yes, and the best analogy is to say that there's a giant supermarket somewhere that charges for all its thousands and thousands of products, but somewhere hidden in the shelves is some item that's free. It costs zero. And all you have to do is go shopping one night and try and find it. And when you find it, you're not charged at the checkout counter. And that's the kind of analogy I think of when I'm on the search for a zero-energy miracle.
All right, and making that miracle come true is something in our philosophy. We have Alberto on the line. Hello, Alberto.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Fine.
You know, I was thinking about the lady who called just a few moments ago. Esther, was that her name?
Esther, yes.
Yeah, right. And, you know, I kind of want to parrot pretty much what she said. I think of situations such as the book Interrupted Journey, I think the Massachusetts couple, and I also think of UFO Contact in Pascagoula. Books that you wonder whether these things actually really happened or whether these were a matter of the people's imaginations taking hold of them and so forth. I also think in terms of the name of the program, Open Mind. And I like to think that I'm one of those people. I think I have an open mind. I think that I'd like to listen to cogent and persuasive arguments in favor of some of these things, and I reach out and I hope to learn, if that's what I have to do, about these episodes and these situations. And then I wonder whether in fact there is any kind of a conspiracy, and I don't mean to insinuate that there is or that I believe that there is, but is that what is happening? Because you have people like Sagan, for instance, and the Cosmos series, and other renowned scientists who not necessarily poo-poo the idea of these things, but have nothing to add to what appears to be a very cogent and persuasive argument, that, for instance, like your guest is carrying on this evening. And my real question is, how can anybody who listens to KABC radio and who has to driving in the morning listen to Ken and Bob say Jenkins Man, and you know, these are weird news items that come about and so forth, how does anybody who is really interested in this thing, who really wants to acquaint himself or herself with these apparently paranormal or at least not physically obvious situations, how does anybody get into this sort of thing? How does anybody really know? How can anybody tell whether your guest, for instance, who appears to be a learned man, how does anybody know about these things? How does anybody go about...
Alberto, I'm listening to your question, and I really do grasp the sense of your question and the real meaning you're looking for. And my answer is not very specific. My answer is, first of all, in order to tell the truth and to discover the truth, it's a very, very difficult subject, and it's a very demanding one, and you really have to devote all your energy to solving some of these problems. And the way is not clear and the path is not easy. And let me be very specific. Let's say you want to discover the mathematical truths concerning these phenomena. If you study hard enough, you soon will encounter Gödel's theorem. That's spelled G-O-D-E-L. And it's pronounced Gödel because of the umlaut over the O. Gödel, I think, won a Nobel Prize for this theorem. He proved that in the 1930s, this work was done, that when you take a mathematical theorem to prove something, that you can never prove anything. That's called Gödel's theorem. You can never prove anything mathematically. Now, that's a horrible thing to say on the open mind, because here we are trying to come to the truth of something, and I tell you there exists a celebrated theorem that says mathematically you cannot prove anything. And there's a reason for this. When you prove something in a logical system, you have to use axioms, and you have to prove a theorem in relation to an axiom. But if you recall from your basic mathematics, axioms go unproven. An axiom is something that's self-declaratory, that stands...
It's an obvious truth.
That it stands without proof. So when you prove a theorem, you're really proving that it's logically consistent with an axiom, but the axiom itself is unproven. So therefore, mathematically, you really can never prove anything in a strict sense. Now, that's baffling. That really makes the work in any scientific field most difficult to a purist who is looking for the idealistic truth of things. And there's ways of getting around it, but they're very, very difficult. And
what about intelligent persuasion, though? In other words, some of us, I'm sure, have listened to Mr. Jenkins for years now. And he has had any number of guests who have been in the what I refer to in the general area of the new age type thinking, and a lot of us, I'm sure, I just have a feeling about this, are open about this whole thing, and we would like to hear persuasive and cogent arguments about these things.
In the case of the UFO here, Alberto, and one of the reasons that we get into it from time to time, and we'll do it next week, by the way, with Larry Fawcett, and who wrote Clear Intent, which will really get into the government's activity here, is that as we look through history, going back into antiquity, we see that this phenomenon, if you want to call it that, has been very accurately recorded, even in the Bible. There are great masterpieces that the Renaissance...
Well, Heirs of the Gods is a book.
Yeah.
That purports to give us some kind of an explanation, or the kind of a thing that perhaps we could latch on to. Basically, as I understand it, would be the idea that there are spatial or space connected ways of looking at the things that the Bible says.
Yes, they did quite an extensive amount of research and coming up with what they did. That's Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden. But to go ahead and answer, you know, more of your question about the kind of proof that we have, we're looking at it being documented throughout history that this was happening by, you know, very skilled and qualified observers. We have, even in our modern day, men like George C. Marshall and Douglas MacArthur, which I'm sure you have a great deal of respect for, that talked about them very much being a part of our reality and a problem for our government. And there's our orchestra. Do you want to hang on, Alberto? And we'll get back to this right after the news,
sure.
Okay? Who for many years has been delving deeply into the UFO and the science that's surrounding the UFO. And before we go any further, we might make mention to you that I'm planning to take as many of you as who want to go, that are members of the KABC Travel Club, and it's very easy to be a part of that, to England with me in May. And thanks to Mr. Slade, we may be able to arrange an audience with the good Lord...
Clancarty.
Clancarty. Lord Clancarty is very involved in the British Parliament's investigation of the UFO. Edwin is very close to Lord Clancarty. And we'll try to work out that audience with the Lord right there at Parliament if you go along with us. We'll also check into the ghost houses, go up and see Stonehenge, and have just an open mind great time. And if you'd like to go, I'd like for you to drop me a letter. Just, you know, say, hey, I'd like to go.
There's no commitment on this, but the fact that you would be interested. And also give me some suggestions about some things that you would like to do that sort of, you know, fit the mood that we have here on this show. But it'll be in May. Chuck Carmelli, who is our the head of our travel club, Chucky Travel we call him, is in England right now making those arrangements for all of us to go. So we would like for you to go, and of course we'll be giving you more and more details about where we'll be staying, what we'll be doing, how much it'll cost, but it'll be at a great bargain because that's the way we work here at KABC, is save the folks money every time we get a chance. We have Alberto on the line. Alberto, let's continue our conversation. Where were we exactly?
Okay, well, I was just simply going to say, I know a lot of people probably want to talk to you. I hope they do, actually. The UFO contact in Pascagoula is something that I would like your guest to address himself to. I don't know much about that. I do remember reading, of course, the story in the papers, about a couple of years ago, maybe. And it seems as if it was just a flash in the pan type thing. They mentioned it, and you saw it a couple of days, and then everybody forgets about it. Nobody pursues it. These people, two of them, I think, I don't see that anybody has interviewed them. I don't see any
number of things done about the two gentlemen involved. There was a lot of television coverage of it. They did a lot of investigation. One of the investigations they found out the people that were involved with that was that they certainly thought they were telling the truth, and they had quite a story to tell. They moved great distances in a short period of time. They certainly were traumatized mentally and physically. They had no reason to come up with this story. You got to look at motivations why people
particularly physically. I was amazed that they were able to say that they felt themselves floating into. And they had no...
As if they were lifted up by some
exactly,
sort of...
Exactly. Like they had, there was nothing about gravity holding them back. And it seemed like some kind of a force simply grabbed them, as it were, and just they were floated into this situation and they were helpless about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say goodnight now, but I wish you would... tell us a little bit more about that. What things you have been able to determine about not necessarily the how these things are happen in the physical world. I mean, I look out my window right now and I see some trees. If I turn my back, the trees are still there, but they're not obvious to me. They're not obvious to the senses.
Mm-hmm.
And yet if I turn back again, I see them right. But is that just the pigment of my senses? Or are those things going to be out there, that kind of thing?
That's the perception of your senses.
Well, Alberto, if you're interested in anti-gravity, let me give you this kind of a mind experiment. Einstein was always famous for his mind experiments, which is something you don't need a laboratory for. You just imagine them. And they were called Gedanken experiments because in German that word means you just think about it. And it's responsible for a lot of contributions in science. And let's say you're studying the problem of anti-gravity or how can matter be made to float. We know it's a zero energy miracle. It doesn't require much energy to do it. We just don't know the mechanism of how to do it. So suppose you're a gravity or an anti-gravity researcher and you want to grab a hold of the concept of how you can make matter become immune from gravity. Well, you can think of this experiment. You dissect particles and get smaller and smaller particles and keep reducing their size by cutting them in half, and this was an old technique that was used by Aristotle. Until you get down to the atom, or till you get down to the basic building block of matter, and you further reduce it by dissecting it and making it into its elementary components. And what you try to do is look for the fundamental particle of matter, and you find out that you can put a test. You can say that one thing you know about all matter, and that is gravity attracts it to all other matter. So gravity is a force that penetrates all particles and makes them move by gravitational attraction. And Newton discovered this law and made the law of gravity in a quantified form. But here's my point. If a piece of elementary matter is to perform and behave like matter should. It has to do three things. It has to sense where the other matter is in the universe so that it could sense what's pulling on it at the moment. So if you're a little piece of matter in the moon, then you have to know that the sun is pulling on you from somewhere else. So there's some part of the matter that senses the other matter in the universe. Now, you have to sense all the matter in the universe and add up the forces to get to a resultant force, which is the net pull on that elementary particle. So there's another part of matter that does the computation. Let's call that the processing or the computer processing part of matter. It does have to compute the sum total of all the little forces. Now there's a third function that has to happen, and that is that the elementary particle of matter now has to start moving and traveling in the right direction, which is the summation of all the forces pulling on it. So